We're discussing a handful of the cases taken up by the conservative law firm, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL. Founder, president, and general counsel Rick Essenberg is on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some roadmap here for conversation. Did Dane County overstep its authority with local mask mandates? The state Supreme Court is considering WILL's challenge there. The legislature's parental bill of rights on the table and WILL expanding litigation in the area of K-12 schools. And we start with redistricting and WILL joining the legislature in appealing the state's Supreme Court's decision for electoral maps put forth by Governor Evers. How do you find a middle ground with partisan fairness and keep competitive districts? Should the U.S. Supreme Court, should SCOTUS take up the appeal? 800-642-1234. Rick Essenberg, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Good morning. So let's start with the state legislature versus the Wisconsin Elections Commission case, the legislature appealing the state Supreme Court's decision. And we will get to the Voting Rights Act in just a moment. But I want to explore with you core retention, because Justice Hagedorn built his opinion around this measurement of core retention, so counting the number of people who will change election districts when they vote and moving the fewest number of people as possible. Do you feel core retention satisfies the least change objective?
Well, I think it's a way of measuring the least change objective. It's not the only way. It's an aggregate measure. It applies to the whole state. So it would not pick up dramatic changes in one part of the state and could be balanced by less dramatic changes elsewhere. I think it's a tool. I also think that it's a rough tool, so that if we're looking at competing maps and they're very, very close on core retention, it's difficult to say on that number alone that one is preferable to the other on the least change measure. They more accurately say that they both complied with it. I think that one of the things that may have happened here is that the core retention became a metric which perhaps was given too much weight in assessing the least changes aspect of the maps and some of the other things that maps had to comply with. They had to be equal in population, they have to be contiguous and compact. Therein lies some of the difference between the parties in which maps would be selected. But the appeal to the Supreme Court is much more limited. That only involves the Voting Rights Act.
Well, let's talk about the Voting Rights Act, protecting the right of Black and Latino voters to elect candidates of their choice when drawing district lines. How do you think that Governor Evers' map that creates 7 majority Black districts, one more than the 2011 map, how is that worse off for representation of minority voters?
Well, so we have a tension with the Voting Rights Act. And the Voting Rights Act, as it has been interpreted, in some instances allows the government to do something that it normally cannot do, and that is to make decisions based upon race. Right? In the absence of some compulsion from the Voting Rights Act, we would normally consider it unconstitutional for the government to take race into account in drawing maps. Well, here we know that the governor took race into account in drawing maps in Milwaukee County. He deliberately spread Black voters among a greater number of districts so he could create 7 barely majority Black majority districts. So the question becomes, is that unconstitutional for the government to act in this race-based manner? It might not be if you could establish that the doing so was required by the Voting Rights Act. But the Voting Rights Act is not simply a mandate to maximize minority participation. It is a law that allows courts to remedy some particular barrier to full participation suffered by specific minority groups. In this case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court declined to find, a majority did not say, that the seventh majority district was required by the Voting Rights Act. And so the question becomes, if it was not required by the Voting Rights Act, and it seems unlikely that it could have been, because if you can draw seven districts with 50.1% of the population and still have minorities with an opportunity to elect the candidates of their choice, then there probably isn't a current barrier to participation on behalf of those voters. But given the fact that there was no finding of a Voting Rights Act violation, is it even permissible to take into race into account in drawing these districts? And that's the issue that the Supreme Court has been asked to address.
Let me reintroduce you for a moment. Rick Essenberg is here, founder and president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. As we look at cases Will has been taking up, and as we talk about the state legislature versus the Wisconsin Elections Commission that SCOTUS could take up, before we move on here, this Supreme Court has described the harm in racial gerrymandering cases as, quote, personal and individualized. Does the legislature have standing here in that the map drawing inflicts institutional injury on the legislature?
Well, I think that the voters of Wisconsin, as a general matter, legislators or voters, have an interest in not having their government act on the basis of race without sufficient justification. Perhaps, again, as we said, a demonstrated violation of the Voting Rights Act would be justification for drawing maps based upon racial lines, but we don't believe that the governor or the other interveners who were arguing for this greater number of majority-minority maps in the Milwaukee area established a Voting Rights Act violation that could have justified this, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court never found it.
I'm sorry to jump in here, but what about packing under the Voting Rights Act? Would the risk of packing Black voters arise under a six district configuration in a way that drawing seven majority Black districts would avoid this problem?
Well, I don't think so. And you can always argue that the seventh district constituted vote dilution, right? Which is the opposite. And in fact, some of the minority legislators in Milwaukee don't like these maps because they believe that the voting power of Black citizens is diluted by them. You know, we typically think in a Voting Rights Act case that a remedy is warranted when there's some type of barrier to participation by minority voters. Because there is this barrier to participation by minority voters, courts would typically require that there be a supermajority of minority voters in a voting rights district, that there be, not 50.1% a Black voting age population, but 55%, 60%. And that makes sense if you think about it, because if there's a barrier for these folks to participate, then they need a supermajority in order to have an opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. But here, that's not what happened. The governor took the Black voting age percentage and he reduced it. He reduced it to 50.1%, and it's very difficult to argue.
So here's the thing.
The group has 50.1% that it can't elect candidates of, and can still elect candidates of its choice, then there must not be a barrier for its participation, because anybody with 50.1% could do that.
Okay, we're in crunch time here, but I do want to fit in this one question, because a Marquette University analysis found all maps would likely maintain a big Republican majority in the legislature, but the plan drawn by GOP lawmakers could give Republicans a shot at a veto-proof supermajority. Do you think Republicans pushed too far here with map proposals tilted too in favor of one party?
Well, we didn't submit maps, and one of our objectives was as follows. Going into any redistricting process, Democrats here in Wisconsin are faced with a disadvantage, and that is that their voters are more geographically concentrated. And a lot of litigation that took place in the teens was an effort by Democrats to ask courts to make up for that to draw districts in a way which essentially gerrymander in a way that would remove this natural disadvantage. I can't see that that is any less a partisan exercise than what Republicans are accused of engaging into. So we ask the court, when you draw these maps, don't even look at the partisan outcome. Don't ask the parties to calculate it. Don't take it into account. Just look and make sure that the maps are equal in participation, contiguous, compact, and adopt a least changes approach. And so when we went into the part of the litigation where maps were submitted, those were the rules of the game. I am sure that that precluded the governor from submitting the kind of maps that he really wanted to submit. And so there's something a little hollow in his claims of victory, because by the time we got to the submitting to the map stages, he's really was playing under a set of rules that he didn't want to play under. He wanted to have more freedom, I think, to make up for this natural disadvantage that Democrats have.
Let's just pause right here with Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty President Rick Essenberg explaining cases. This first case his firm is litigating and why. What questions do you have about will-related lawsuits in the area of the electoral maps appeal, as we've been talking about, K-12 education and mask restrictions, the power of a health department? How should schools handle students who want to be identified by one gender, but their parents disagree? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Rick Essenberg here on the Ideas Network. We're with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, or WILL, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Founded in 2011, it calls itself one of the largest state-based litigation centers in the country, now expanding its services, adding an attorney who will focus on legal and policy issues in Wisconsin K-12 education area. What questions do you have for the head of WILL? With no specific federal law existing about mask mandates, do public health officers have the power to enforce public health guidelines? 800-642-1234. WILL's President Rick Essenberg stays with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's move on to Becker versus Dane County, challenging the authority of the Dane County health officer in issuing emergency pandemic orders. You filed the case on behalf of 2 Dane County residents and a business in response to the emergency pandemic orders. So here's the thing. I mean, the state Supreme Court struck down Evers' mask mandate 1 year ago this month. Indoor mask mandates in Dane County expired March 1st. What is the point of still litigating this?
Well, I think that the reason that the court is still litigating is it's possible for this issue to arise in the future. And the Supreme Court is a law-developing court and has expressed an interest in clarifying what the law should be. I mean, if you look at all the COVID cases that we filed, and we filed quite a few of them, they rarely, if ever, addressed whether or not what was being done was a good policy or a bad policy. We never argued about whether there should be a mask mandate or not be a mask mandate in the state of Wisconsin. What we said was that if you're going to have a mask mandate, it has to be adopted in the proper way. Now, some people might think, well, why does that matter? If I like what the government has done, why do I care about how they do it? But the problem is that, we live in a country. Which is characterized by the rule of law. There are certain ways that we make law. There are certain ways that we command people to do certain things. And there are certain things that we should not want our public officials to be able to do. So for example, we argued that we didn't think that the governor should be able to grab emergency powers for consecutive 60-day periods, on and on and on and on and on, because during that period of time, he had extraordinary authority to make the law in a way which is inconsistent with our separation of powers. Here in the Becker case, our view is that if we're going to have the type of restrictions that were put in place by Madison, it can't simply be done by delegating to a public health official the authority to do basically anything he or she wants. Well, but what's important is the legislative body, the county board, endorse this so that we have maximum public participation in establishing the rules and restrictions under which we're going to live.
Well, here, you know, conservatives frame this litigation or this wave of legislating, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but, you know, as you look at this against public health agencies as a matter of individual liberties, do you worry about unintended consequences stretching far beyond a COVID pandemic to strip health departments of their longtime roles to keep us safe, like even having the authority to shut down a restaurant to keep our food safe? I mean, what are the unintended consequences here?
Well, so again, you have to be, you have to look at the particular case and the particular claims that are being made. Public health officials would still have the power to use existing standards that had been approved by the legislature to shut down restaurants if there was a problem with a restaurant. What we're talking about here is the extent to which public health officials acting unilaterally, without action by the legislature, without action by the local legislative body, in this case, the county board, can effectively make law, can effectively be deputized by the legislative body as lawmakers. This creates a problem which we often call non-delegation. Mm-hmm. This idea that we live in a system where legislative bodies make the law, executive agencies carry the law out. And we want these executive bodies, these public health officials, to have adequate direction going into a crisis, rather than simply tell them you can do whatever you want, because that arrogates too much power in the hands of a single individual and does not allow the type of public participation, which is very, very important, even when, and maybe perhaps especially when, we're faced with something particularly threatening and frightening.
Especially, but, you know, when time is something that you really are up against, that you have to make a change in a split second in order to make sure that you're saving.
Sure, there are provisions
there
are provisions for emergency actions, right?
Okay.
The governor can declare an emergency and act until the legislature can come into session. It's 60 days. The legislature can repeal it at any time. But that's not what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
What happened here is the governor declared 60 days emergency. When the 60-day emergency was over, he declared another one. When that was over, he declared another one. So that, as far as the governor was concerned, we were going to live under a perpetual state of emergency. We don't believe that that's what the law was designed to do. The law was designed for him to declare one emergency, get the legislature in there, and you know, fashion a set of policy responses that's appropriate to the circumstance. You shouldn't want the governor to be able to declare emergencies in series and then exercise or issue any order he wanted, because no matter how much you like Governor Evers, there will be a governor someday that you don't like as well.
Well, I do want to fit in our last case here, Rick Essenberg, president of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. I just want to, and I know we're short here in time, but John Doe et al. Versus Madison Metropolitan School District, parents represented by you challenging a Madison Metropolitan School District's gender identity guidance first adopted in 2018 for how to support transgender, non-binary, gender expansive students. What do you want the court to do here?
Well, what we want the court to do, what we want the Madison School District to do, is to respect the right of some parents. The district has essentially taken a position that anytime any child at any age expresses the desire to transition, that is treated as the final word, and the child is permitted to socially transition at school. Now, that may be the appropriate response in a particular case, but it may not be, because we know that most times, the huge percentage of times when children present with gender dysphoria, it desists over time.
But what about students who, you know, who are transitioning at school and their parents don't know yet?
Well, and that's the problem. Right? Madison is conspiring with these students.
This is guidance.
Yes, it is. It's conspiring with these students to lock their parents out of the decision making. Now, we typically don't do that with important medical decisions that children make. We trust until until someone proves otherwise, we trust parents to know their children and to do what's best for them. And the case simply asks that the parents be involved, that the parents not be deceived by the school, and that this is, in fact, good health practice, because most of the time, these situations will desist over time. They will not persist. I mean, that's something that nobody wants to talk about, but that is an absolute medical fact. And so, having the parents involved, parents who know their child better than anyone else, is generally considered to be a good thing. It's considered to be a good thing in dealing with other types of you know, mental and physical health problems. It's a good thing in determining dealing with the discipline problems and academic problems, and it's a good thing here as well.
And Rick, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Rick Essenberg, founder, president, and general counsel for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now, the State Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, says Wisconsin has more than 15,000 lakes. But according to a naturalist in Manitowish, only 136 of those lakes are actually wild lakes, that is, still mostly untouched by human development. John Bates's book is called Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, A Guide to the Last Undeveloped Natural Lakes. And in the book, he profiles dozens of what he considers his favorite wild lakes. He also includes essays about an assortment of lake-centric subjects, like the rehabilitation of the state's trumpeter swan population. John Bates recently talked about the book and his research with WPR host Lee Rayburn.
So, John, let's start with a simple question. What compelled you to write this book?
Several things. One was my own personal sense of adventure. I love going to wild places that few people have ever been to or go to now. I find a lot of joy in being in peaceful, quiet places. So that sense of adventure of just traveling around the state was enticing. And I really believe in the old statement of putting yourself in the way of grace. And that is really what happened in this 4 years of messing around all around northern Wisconsin. Put myself in the way of grace a lot in the sense of coming to extraordinarily beautiful, peaceful places and trying to briefly be a part of those places. So there was that from a personal standpoint. And then from a writing standpoint, I wanted to do this because I really believe that the way we protect the natural world is through our love of places. We only protect what we love. We won't sit in front of bulldozers or write letters to Congress people or act in a way that can create change unless we really are passionate about things. So my hope is that getting people to some of these wild places will enhance and deepen their love of these places such that they will work to conserve them and potentially to try to entice the DNR to and the feds to purchase more wild lakes. So because we really don't have that many. So
Well, forgive me for thinking this, John, but your love of our wild lakes in Wisconsin comes through in your book. And I have to wonder if there is an unintended consequence that you could have these wild lakes may not be as wild as they used to be once they catch on.
Well, that's a legitimate concern. We are very capable of loving places to death, and we've seen that happen in many other places. I would counter that, the opposite side of the coin being that my hope being the people will fall more deeply in love with the places by having visited them and will then work to conserve them. So maybe there's an inherent risk that some places may get more use than they have. I'm hoping that that use translates into better conservation, more political action, deeper love.
And one of the things you document in Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, John Bates, is, you know, how many people you see out there, how many tourists come out there, or how much portaging you have to do to get there in the first place.
Right. So a lot of these lakes, not too many people are going to be that crazy enough to portage into, to be honest. I don't, and in fact, there were 10 lakes out of all that we went to, which was somewhere in a range of 138 lakes. There were 10 lakes we never even got to because we weren't willing to suffer enough to get to them. you know, you had to cross a half mile of bog, or the road, the old road in was completely grown over, and it would have been a bushwhack of a quarter mile or more. So we left 10 lakes that I describe in there and say, you know, we never got there. Good luck.
You sure can. John Bates is a Wisconsin naturalist and author. He wrote the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, here on the Ideas Network. He's our guest. And I, let's take a step back for a second here, John, and because this debate comes up when we hear Minnesota and Wisconsin fighting over who has the most lakes, and this would go into John Bates' definition of a lake. How do you see a lake?
Yeah, so Wisconsin is said to have over 15,000 lakes. You need to temper that with the fact that over 6,000 of those lakes aren't even named. They're so small. My understanding is that those 15,000 the number comes from lakes 2.2 acres or larger. So those are, you know, what's the difference between a pond and a lake? Who knows? Minnesota defines lakes as anything larger than 10 acres. So one way or another, Minnesota wins the battle easily of having far more lakes than we do, based on defining the lake anyway as 10 acres or more, or even larger at 25 acres or more.
Well, in your experience, do you think that definition is fair? Because it sounds like there were a number of lakes that you traversed in your book that were smaller than 10 acres.
Well, there weren't actually.
Really?
All the lakes that I have in the book are 30 acres or larger. That was an arbitrary definition that I worked with, because to go to all of the smaller, really tiny pothole lakes the book would never have happened. I would have died. I'm 70 years old now. I don't think I would have made it. So you had to draw a line somewhere. I wanted to have lakes included that were large enough that if you put a kayak or canoe on, that you would have a paddle of, you know, at least 15, 20 minutes to go around the periphery of the lake. You know, a little 3-acre, 4-acre lake, there's not a whole lot of water. And so it was just an arbitrary definition that I used.
So we have John Bates' definition of a lake. What do you consider a wild lake? Because there are some where you have tourists, there are some where you have fishermen, there are some where you have hunters. What's a wild lake to you?
Yeah. Well, again, an arbitrary definition on my part. So I used a number of criteria. One, the most important to me, was totally surrounded by public lands. So that all of these lakes, you will not see a single private home on. However, you may see a state or federal campground on it. So you might see a camper or something along a shoreline on some of these. You may see a dock into the water at a boat landing. And on a few of the lakes, in fact, there are either electric motors allowed, or on two or three of the lakes, motorboats are permitted. Nonetheless, they are completely undeveloped, publicly owned lakes, and thus are wild by my definition of non-privatized.
John Bates, our guest, naturalist and author of the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. And John, give us some idea here of how our human ecology and modern technology has affected Wisconsin's lakes and their environs.
The very simple and obvious statement is that on a developed lake, you have less canopy cover along the shoreline, less shrub cover along the shoreline, and less understory cover, because people have spent a small fortune, the family jewels, to purchase a shoreline property, and they want to have a viewscape of that lake. And in doing so, in altering the shoreline vegetation, they alter the bird population, they alter the frog population along the shoreline by taking out woody debris along the shoreline, so they have more space for swimming and boating. They're altering the fish populations and aquatic insect populations. So there are consequences to our love of water and our development of water. So and there's consequences to the use of motorboats on water and stirring up sediments in shallow areas and wave erosions along shorelines. So these things are easily noted along developed lakes. And one of the differences, of course, in a wild lake is that shoreline is still wild. And that was one of the beautiful things that I really enjoyed. A number of lakes of, you know, going along these shorelines and seeing, for instance, trees that have fallen into the water, and they've been there so long, they've been colonized by mosses, and then the mosses have been colonized by bog plants, and you have this kind of a mini bog community.
Yeah, one of the places you detail this, John, is in Dry Lake in Vilas County, and they're these bryozoans, is that what they're called?
Yeah, that's exactly what they're called. Yeah, they're moss animals. And they look like a giant brain, something from outer space. I've had many people over the years call me up and say, "What in God's name is this thing I just found in our in
I
our
found
lake?"
A brain.
And, yeah, it's a big blob. It looks like a gelatinous mass, and it's kind of hard. But they're really odd, bizarre creatures. They're made up of this colony of things called zoids. You got to look at them under a microscope, and they have these little cilia, kind of hair-like tentacles that they extend out in the water, and they filter feed out of this blob. They're just bizarre and unique and really specific to cleaner water. So if you do have them, that speaks well for the quality of your water.
That is author and naturalist John Bates talking with WPR host Lee Rayburn. They will continue this conversation about his research for the book Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, A Guide to the Last Undeveloped Natural Lakes, here on The Morning Show. Stay with us. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for being along with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. Now let's get back to the research behind Wisconsin's wildest lakes. My colleague Lee Rayburn talked with naturalist John Bates about the most pristine, undeveloped lakes in our state and how we should regard them.
One of the other aspects that you mention in your book, John Bates, which is Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, is the decline in our loon population and going back to our encroachment on natural habitats and where we meet natural wildlife. You have these moments in your book. It's just you and the canoe and the sound of the loon. And you mentioned grace at this when we began the conversation, and that's what it sounds like in my head. But what can be done with our wild lakes, with what we have left of the natural habitat in Wisconsin, to restore the population of loons in our state?
A fellow named Dr. Walter Piper in Oneida County has been following upwards of 200 lakes in Oneida County for, 30 years now. And what he's finding is a decline, not in the adult population, but in the juvenile population that's returning, and a lack of a successful reproduction in chicks, a less robust reproduction. Anyway, he's unsure what the causes are. So caution is always the principle one needs to approach these things with. We need to manage all the lakes that we have that have loons on them as carefully as we can. And for the most part, I think we are. Got to limit motorboat use anywhere near a loon nest. Got to manage water levels if there's a dam on a lake or a river that's increasing water during the spring can flood out a nest. There's a host of things that we can do, but the problem with loons is they're a migratory bird, and they're going down to the Gulf of Mexico for 3 years before they return. And there's a lot that's going on down there too, and in places in between. So as with all birds that are migratorial, the issue of conservation becomes muddy. We can't just protect everything here in Wisconsin. We have to protect everything between here and wherever they end up in a wintering ground.
You also, in your book, repeatedly refer to the water levels in the state of Wisconsin's lakes and how they run on about a 13-year cycle, but in the last 4 years, those water levels have been pretty high, and you allude to what that can do to a loon nest. What are some of the other effects that you saw as you were paddling around with the high water levels?
Yeah, boy, I found, particularly on seepage lakes, these lakes that don't have a lot of don't have any inflow or outflow of water that are particularly receive their water from precipitation, because we've had so much precipitation in the last decade. They're like 3 feet higher than the ordinary water level, so the shorelines were drowned. Lots of shrubs and trees, white birches, white pines around the shoreline, they're standing in a foot or two of water. It's pretty crazy actually looking. So there's a lot of dying going along, happening along the shoreline of these plants, and a lot of aquatic plants that, you know, are ordinarily just off the shoreline in a foot of water are now in 4 feet of water, and they're not necessarily adapted to being in deeper water. So you're seeing a bit of a change in composition of plants. But this year, this summer, precipitation was way down, so a number of the lakes came down from where they were. I was talking to a fellow actually last night about a lake, and he said it was 50 inches above normal high water mark, but it had come down 12 inches this year. Well, that's great, but it's still 38 inches above where it's supposed to be. That's a lot of water up onto the shoreland. Yeah.
John Bates is our guest here on the Ideas Network, a Wisconsin naturalist and the author. He wrote the new book, Wisconsin's Wild Lakes. And John, getting a little bit of perspective here from your, in your opinion, how were these lakes, how have these lakes in Wisconsin been able to stay wild?
Well, a place is a space with a story, right? So there's a story with every one of these lakes of why they got saved. The problem with that I found was I couldn't find the stories. Those are stories to be teased down. And I'm hoping as part of this book that I'll get lots of emails and phone calls from people saying, you know what, I got the story on this lake and I'd love to tell you. And then I can hopefully do future editions and say, okay, here, let's fill out this story. Because this, I'd love to just to know why every lake has a specific name. I found a few, but somebody gave a name to this place. Why is this one lake called Grandma Lake? Well, who is Grandma?
Yes.
Why is this one called Jenny Lake? Well, who the hell was Jenny? So that kind of stuff. And then I wanted as well to try to find the original Ojibwe names.
Oh.
Because I thought that would be fascinating, because usually that would describe in some manner what the lake was known to them for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found a few, but by and large, the wild lakes that are left are small lakes that weren't, they may have been named, but those names have been lost. The names that I did find are attached to much larger, are more beautiful lakes that are, of course, were the first developed. So we have quite a few Ojibwe names known, but again, for developed lakes. So I wasn't able to give the many lakes at all their original Ojibwe names for the wild lakes I described in the book.
But one of the central themes to these wild lakes, John, seems to be the public lands are available for all of us to access these waters.
Right.
And the fact that they're, to some degree, protected for natural habitat and wild animals.
Yeah, you know, we used to have back in the late 1990s and into the early 2000s a program to actually purchase more of these public properties, or they would be private properties at the time, but then bring them into public ownership. It was a Wild Lakes program. And one of the things I advocate for in the book is a reinstatement of that particular program. It's expensive to buy shoreland, but what I found were quite a number of lakes that had only one owner, and it may in some cases be an entire lake owned by one person, but it may also have been a lake with just one small inholding of 10% of the shoreline, 90% state owned. It would be wonderful if we could somehow pungle up the money and say, this matters to us. Let's increase the number. Because I found really not very many, a very small percentage of lakes left in northern Wisconsin that are wild. And those that I found were generally smaller, generally very shallow, and often silty, mucky kind of bottoms that were the least desirable to be developed. Now, I happen to love those lakes because they're full of waterfowl, full of songbirds, fabulous plant life, but they're not a place you're going to go water skiing or swimming necessarily. These are often bog or wetland kind of lakes. But anyway, I'd love to see us reinstitute that because, you know, we're not making land anymore and we're certainly not making lakes anymore. So let's protect what we can, all voluntarily, not having the DNR condemn anybody's property. But if someone's a willing seller, let's go for it.
John Bates, the author of Wisconsin's Wildest Lakes, joining us. And John, give me, as a Wisconsin naturalist, I'm curious what it's like for you to enter a lake for the first time. Give me some idea of what it's like to prepare to go into this lake for the first time and how you are trying to document it to share with others.
When you first, you know, pull up to a lake and you're unloading your boat, there's all this excitement and anticipation as a general rule. And what I have to remind myself anyway is to breathe. Just slow down. I've probably driven 55 miles an hour to get to this place, you know, And I'm finally there and I'm just excited. And I have to try to belong. I have to be a part of a place. And the only way I'm a part of a place is if I shut my mouth for one, don't make any further noise. And I need to shut my brain off too. I don't need to be present. I need to be in the moment. And that sometimes takes a little while. And I didn't always succeed in that, but that's what I would ask everybody to do, you know, or try to do when you come to a wild place like this, is to sit along the shore, maybe for a little while, calm yourself, try to just listen, try to be a part of the place, not to be a broadcaster of all of your noise and bang, bang, and, you know, you're hitting your paddle against your boat, so, you know, all that kind of stuff, but rather be a receiver, be that person who is hearing and seeing everything, and going slow along the shoreline. Just go really slow. We're taught as kids to quit poking around. We need to teach ourselves as adults to start poking around. We need to really poke around slow, look at things. That's a skill that very few people have. We tend to want to get from point A to point B and say we did it. Well, the exploration of these wild lakes isn't an endpoint that you're seeking. You're seeking all the things in between and having a relationship to them, having some connection to them, having a deeper appreciation for them. So I think that's what I call for people to do in the introduction, to approach these places with as peaceful and as quiet a mind as they can, and to not be approaching them as a resource opportunity. I want to catch as many fish as I can or shoot as many ducks as I can. People can do that by all means and will do that. But I hope that's a secondary thought. I hope that the first and foremost thought is to love the beauty, just fall in love with these places, and be healed by them. Frankly, I think the world needs a whole lot of healing these days and needs a lot of inspiration. And these wild places provide both that healing and inspiration.
John, thank you for sharing the beauty with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that was naturalist John Bates talking with WPR host Lee Rayburn. The book is called Wisconsin's Wild Lakes, A Guide to the Last Undeveloped Natural Lakes. And our state's precious natural resources, like lakes, is one topic of conversation on the morning show. So where should we go next? Where should we go deep and slow down, as John Bates says? What would you like us to cover that you want to weigh in on? Share your conversation ideas by visiting WPR.org/mornings. And there you can listen to recent discussions. You can share your ideas for future programs by submitting a super easy 2-question form. You can also send program ideas our way by email. That's ideas@WPR.org. And thank you so much for being part of the conversation. Just ahead, we get tips for cooking with a wok from cookbook author and YouTube star J. Kenzie Lopez-Alt is here. Do you have a wok in your kitchen? How do you use it? Join our conversation with your questions and experiences with your wok with Stir Fries, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.